I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're going to have so many interesting items of conversation after this hour. You can just talk and be interesting all weekend long. We're talking about Scientific American's Fact or Fiction and Strange but True Columns. It's now an e-book, and it tackles 58 popular myths and presents a sampling of the surprising and fascinating, useful, and just plain wacky topics discussed by their writers over the years. Do pets protect children against allergies? Can a cockroach live if you cut its head off? Vitamin supplements, can they improve your health? Do cell phones cause brain cancer? Well, there are all kinds of interesting pieces of information, and we're going to talk about some of them during the course of this hour and welcome your phone calls as well. Our guest is the editor of Scientific American, David Biello, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. And we welcome you to the program. Thanks, David, so much for being with us.
No problem. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. If we could, please, let's talk about elephants, because I find them absolutely fascinating. And from reading your piece and all the research that you cited in your book, it makes me want to do a show on elephants. So that's going to be coming up sometime.
You definitely should.
They're just amazing. So do they ever forget?
It would appear not. That is a fact. Elephants may even have better memories than we do. Elephants that have been separated for many, many years will recognize each other when brought back into contact, when scientists have tested them with various urine samples, which is not, of course, how humans greet each other, but apparently plays a role in elephant society. They will recognize urine samples from their close peers. And it's believed that this memory helps them to kind of navigate the world they live in, to survive droughts. Elephants live in a kind of matriarchal society, and
yes.
These older matriarchs are responsible for guiding the herd to maybe dimly remembered watering spots that then allow the herd to survive some of these droughts.
Hmm. So the older the matriarch, and if she's got a sharp memory, the better off you are if you stay
exactly.
with her.
Mm-hmm. Stick with grandma.
That's the line from this hour. Stick with grandma. That's great, David. Well, you start the article with this elephant. She was at a sanctuary in Tennessee, and she became, Jenny her name was, and she became, you know, kind of anxious when she was introduced to Shirley, and Shirley was anxious too. And it turned out they had worked together in a circus 23 years earlier. 23
That's right.
years. For not
That's right.
a whole long period of time.
That's correct, and they did remember each other, and that goes to show that elephant memories might be better than human ones, because I probably don't recall all my short-term coworkers from 23 years ago.
Absolutely. You may look at their face and say, I don't even think I know you.
Exactly. You
but
might
you
pass
do.
Them on the street.
Right.
But elephants are wonderful animals, and unfortunately, you know, threatened animals.
Yeah.
Their memory is not protecting them from us.
They're very smart, and they also recognize themselves in a mirror, don't they?
They do, yeah. Which is a very small subset of animals. There's us. There's our close relatives, the great apes. There's the dolphins, and then there are elephants.
Hmm. So, David, has anybody ever said to you, I don't think they have said it to me, David, you've got a memory like an elephant?
No. I can't be accused of that. Sometimes I don't even remember the articles I wrote, 2 days ago, let alone 23 years ago. So that hasn't happened, but I aspire to that title.
Good. Okay. Well, you can always work on it. Elephants,
right.
it just comes naturally to elephants, but to we
That's
humans,
right.
It's a different story. Chocolate. Now, this is something that I'm a dog lover, and I've always been really, really careful about chocolate. around my dogs. It is very, very commonly held idea that chocolate is poisonous to dogs. It's not good for dogs, but it depends on what?
The dose is the poison, as the saying goes. It depends on the size of your dog and how much chocolate you're giving them. So this is indeed a fact. Chocolate is not good for dogs. That's because of the theobromine is the name of the chemical in chocolate that makes us like it, but makes it dangerous for dogs. So a small dog might eat a small amount of chocolate and be poisoned by the theobromine and some of the other chemicals in there, whereas a larger dog might be okay at that same dose. The bigger the dose, the worse off you are, and you're best off, just as you said, keeping your dog away from the chocolate and the coffee too. Caffeine is not good for dogs.
And yet, this may be something that's overblown, because I think that you highlight some veterinary school in somewhere in the United States where on Valentine's Day they did see an increased number of dogs coming in, but there haven't been a lot of dogs who have died because of chocolate poisoning.
That's right. It's dangerous, but like I said, unless you're feeding a big dog a large dose, they will probably survive it. It makes their hearts race. Oh. So unless they have a underlying condition, mm-hmm. which that can exacerbate, they'll probably be okay. And this is based on chatting with the ASPCA's Animal Control Poison Center. It's better to be safe than sorry with with your family's best friend. But, you know, if they scarf up one of those, Hershey chocolate bar minis right after Halloween, they'll probably be okay as long as they're not a chihuahua.
Yeah, be very careful if it's a chihuahua. And you say right at the beginning of the article, which I never really thought about, I wonder why this is true, that dogs and humans have similar tastes.
Yes. In general, anything that that people eat, dogs will eat. We've kind of grown up together as species. Chocolate is one of those things that that is fine for people and not fine for dogs.
Are there certain, I'm wondering if, I don't know if you know this or not, it was in the article, but I think about my dog, probably the only thing that he won't eat, there might have to be more things than this, but he really won't eat grapes if you give him a grape. And I've always wondered, are grapes poisoned? Are there certain foods that dogs will shy away from because they instinctively know that they're dangerous, and you wonder why they wouldn't know that about chocolate?
Yeah, I don't know the answer on grapes, but what I would say is that dogs are picking up cues from you, and for the most part, if you're eating it, then they're going to think it's probably okay. Obviously, dogs prefer meat and things of that nature, meats and fats, to vegetables and fruits, whereas we're a little bit more omnivorous, but they will. There are plenty of dogs who will eat, eat their broccoli, probably better than some human children. Dogs obey their masters, I guess, is the best way to put it.
We hope they do. We'll get back to dogs in a moment because they're always one of my favorite topics. I love dogs.
Yeah.
Babies?
Well,
I'm sorry.
For cat lovers, I have one piece of bad news.
Oh.
They can't taste the sweetness in the chocolate, so don't bother.
Oh.
Cats can't taste sweets.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. They, as carnivores, as exclusive meat eaters, they just don't have the receptors to taste sweets.
I didn't know
that.
Sad
for cats. Sad for cats.
So they wouldn't even want to eat a piece of chocolate.
That's right.
Oh, how interesting. Huh. Well, we'll get back to dogs. Let's go to babies. Babies, this is an interesting one. Babies, is it true that they resemble their fathers more than their mothers when they are born? What would be the thinking behind that, and is that true?
Well, the jury is still slightly out on this, but mostly we believe, based on the latest science, that it is fiction. This is based on picture tests that were conducted over many years by a variety of social scientists, and they found that independent observers were better at predicting who a baby's father was than who a baby's mother was. But that was just one test, and when they repeated it, that seeming correlation disappeared. So it seems that this is more fiction than fact, but like I said, perhaps not enough research has been done to definitively prove it one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
The thinking is, however, that obviously a baby's mother knows definitively that they are the mother of said child because obviously the mother gave birth to that child.
Yes.
But the fathers don't necessarily 100% know that they are the father. Certainly in caveman days, maybe there was a little more philandering going on. And so the thought was that perhaps babies would take on the characteristics of their fathers more to kind of prove and therefore gain the support of their fathers. Mm-hmm. Of course, the argument can be made the other way. It would behoove a baby to look like kind of all the fathers in the tribe in order to secure the most benefit. So,
right.
You know, that's how you know you can not necessarily trust these kind of just-so stories that sound good but maybe aren't backed up by the evidence.
Isn't it interesting that almost to a person, though, when a child is born, we all do that. Oh, he has your eyes. Oh, she has your hair. We do that automatically. I wonder why.
Well, I think you know, it's a kind of social way of reinforcing the ties between the parents and the grandparents and you know, the family group and this this new member of that family. I mean,
mm-hmm.
obviously, a lot of those ties don't need reinforcing, but it's kind of you know, a group's way of saying, hey, you know, wow. You know, your daughter looks exactly like you, Dad, and therefore you ought to take care of that daughter.
Right.
Of course, most dads don't need the encouragement.
Right, yeah. So did you study whether or not cavemen had more philandering going on than nowadays?
No, we actually, that's a great idea for a future fact or fiction. I've just made that one up.
I thought about it as you were saying it. Now there's another good one. Babies,
there are lots of them. I mean, we've written hundreds, and I think there are still hundreds to go.
Oh, I'm sure probably thousands to go. Now, this was a big craze. I don't know if it's still around. Maybe it is. Babies exposed to classical music end up smarter. It's the Mozart effect, and people sold, you know, tapes and books and on. It became a huge marketing thing and probably still is.
Oh, absolutely. And this is fiction. It's more marketing than fact. It's based on one kind of long ago study that showed that kids given this paper folding task, you know, they were kind of asked to fold paper into various shapes, did a little bit better when there was music playing. The music happened to be classical music. And some folks kind of took that and ran with it, turned it into the Mozart effect. There's no doubt that music does have effects on both children's brains and people in general. And we obviously like music, but it doesn't seem to matter whether it's classical or whatever else. And the biggest benefit, frankly, is from kind of taking up and playing with an instrument yourself if you really want to kind of build your brain power.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it something how people can make marketing and make a million probably off this one study that was fairly obscure that was a long time ago? And we're gullible, I guess. We want to believe these things, right?
Yeah, well, I would describe it less to being gullible and more that, you know, as parents, I think everybody wants their child to have the best chance in life. And so if there's some hope that something you might do anyway, like play music for your kid, would help them, then why wouldn't you do it? That also seems to be true in some of the other cases that you mentioned, like vitamins.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing wrong with playing music for your baby.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not. Singing to your baby while he or she is still in the womb, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, sing all the time. I think it's a good thing to sing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's welcome phone calls. We have many more of these to go through, and maybe you've got some as well. that you'd like to bring to our attention. Scientific American has Stranger Than Fiction. It's an ebook, and it's really it's a collection of their columns, and there are hundreds of these, but they take on 58 popular myths. What about those vitamins? What about 8 glasses of water a day? What about cockroaches? I'm sorry, but we will talk about cockroaches. We talked about the Mozart effect and elephants being able to remember for an incredibly long period of time. Are there more people alive on the earth right now than have died? We'll take that one on as well. Oh, there are so many of them. And we welcome your phone calls as well. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well. And that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org. We have lines open for you right now. If there's a myth that you would like explored, David maybe has it in the book, or it could be something worth further exploration, because these fact or fiction are found in frequent columns in Scientific American. Cheryl, we've had a number of people, evidently, David, who have called and said that grapes as well as raisins are very bad for dogs. They're toxic and it shuts down their kidneys. So I guess, So I just,
crowdsourcing the answer. There you go.
I know. Isn't that true? Yeah, I love that. All right, look, as long as we're on different kinds of foods, you know, this is something that I thought was always true. Raw vegetables are healthier than cooked vegetables. Turns out not always true, huh?
Absolutely not. That is a fiction. In certain cases, the raw vegetable is better for you, but in others, cooking actually releases some of the vital nutrients and compounds that you want. Or takes away some of the properties that you don't want in the food. So the idea here, of course, is you want to steam those veggies, not fry them in oil. That's usually not the best alternative, although it may be the tastiest alternative. But in certain cases, steamed vegetables are definitely better than their raw counterparts.
Mm-hmm. You do say, though, that vitamin C can be destroyed by cooking some of these vegetables.
That's right. But we tend to get a lot, you know, as long as you're eating your, five servings of fruits and vegetables a day, odds are you're getting all the vitamin C you need. And so even though some of it might be destroyed when you steam that broccoli, the benefits you get from steaming the broccoli kind of outweigh the loss of the vitamin C.
Mm-hmm. And what about these antioxidant vitamins? We hear so much about those. Do those make you healthier?
Sadly, no. So this is another case of marketing, or rather, they don't seem to. The tests that are out there show that there isn't that much protective benefit from antioxidants, which are supposed to kind of go around your body, cleaning up these so-called free radicals that are roaming around and destroying some of the vital compounds in your body, exacerbating aging and things of that nature. Unfortunately, your body is already kind of doing a good enough job of that on its own, and the antioxidants coming in via supplements are not really helping out. That said, the antioxidants that come in the form of food, that come in mixed in with this kind of group of other nutrients, do a better job. So again, eat that boiled or steamed broccoli rather than taking that supplement.
Mm. All right. Let's go to Jay in Prairieville calling in. Hi, Jay.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm okay, Jay. You?
All right. Listen, I was just wondering if this guy can confirm it or not. But see, I hear that the elephants have been losing their jobs. Caterpillar comes in, moves all the trees, so they're kind of out of work. And they've been passing instruments out. And it seems that the harmonica is their favorite. They can play the blues. So at night, all over India, you hear these elephants playing the blues. And I was wondering if anybody's working to bring some over here to do a tour.
Well, I certainly hope so, if that is in fact a fact. I am not familiar with that story, but kind of like with some of the other ideas that have popped up, that sounds like a good fact or fiction for us to explore. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, elephants are amazing.
They are amazing. I can't wait to do our show on elephants. Thanks, Jay, very much. And I'm sure you've seen the Facebook thing that was making the rounds a couple weeks ago. I, of course, posted it because I tend to post dog and elephant things. But it was an elephant who was somewhere in Europe and was joining somebody playing the piano. I mean, he wasn't, or she wasn't, making a sound that was melodious, but the trunk was playing around along with the person playing the piano. It was really something to watch. I got a big kick out of it.
Yeah, it's amazing. I actually have a painting done by an elephant in my house.
Wow. You are a big elephant guy.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, I don't have an elephant, but I have a painting by one, and it's actually, you know, I mean, it's aesthetically pleasing, right? So the elephant had some idea of, I guess, composition and color. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, David, I hate to ask you this, and you always can say no, except I'm asking you on the radio, so how could you say no? Could you send us a picture of that, the picture of what the elephant painted, so we can post that? Or is that too private? Is that okay?
No, sure.
Thank you. We'll look forward to seeing
it. As long as I remember. Remember, I do not have an elephant's memory.
No, but you just told us about it. So we'll remind you. Believe me, if you forget, we'll send you an email. That's really something that you have that. Oh, that's great. We're talking this hour with the editor of Scientific American, who has a picture in his house that was drawn by an elephant. And it's pretty good. And this is prompting us to want to do a show on elephants, which we will pretty soon, because Scotty's taken by all of this as well. Scientific American editor David Biello is our guest here in the Ideas Network, and they have an e-book right now that's Fact or Fiction: Science Tackles 58 Popular Myths, and we're talking about some of them and certainly welcoming your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where there will, after the show, be a picture of the painting by the elephant, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Well, I hate to talk about cockroaches, but I feel as though we must, because it is true that headless cockroaches are capable of living for a long time. Right, David?
That's right. That is a fact. That is a fact. Cockroaches are smarter than you think, and probably just as survivable as people think. I know that when I was growing up, the rumor was that we might all be wiped out by nuclear war, but the cockroaches would survive. I'm not sure that's true, but it is true that they can live without their heads. That's because cockroaches are not organized the way we are. They breathe directly through holes in their exoskeleton. They don't pump a lot of blood around. If you chopped off a person's head, it would obviously bleed to death.
Yeah.
If you chop off a cockroach's head, they can still scuttle around and survive. Insects can live for weeks on a single meal. So even though they can't eat, that headless cockroach will still be alive. And the scientists have proven this. Unfortunately for the cockroaches, however, they are doomed, and they're not as smart. You can actually train cockroaches to do things when they have their heads. Once they lose them, they're pretty much lost.
Thank you so much for all that information. You know, I've never had problems with cockroaches except when I lived in the South. Are they a Southern thing?
Yeah.
They're a Southern thing.
Well, this is the thing about cockroaches, and this is why I think that nuclear war a story is a myth. Cockroaches are tropical bugs, and the reason that they do so well even in northern climes is because we heat our houses. We keep them warm enough for the cockroaches to survive. If we were gone and therefore no longer heating our houses, the cockroaches that were in them, headless or not, would probably die off.
Oh, please, let's move on. Carrie sends us this Facebook message. I heard that cows have a best cow friend. Please tell me if this is true.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I, I cannot answer that, but certainly a lot of good fodder coming up here for future Fact or Fiction columns, and I wouldn't be surprised. A lot of animals both form friendships and play. I guess some people think that it's only people who play, but actually most mammals have been observed doing some form of play in the wild, and what better way to play than with a friend?
Right, yeah. Do living people outnumber the dead?
The answer is no. I like the way you just went straight for it. There are about 7 billion of us on the planet today, according to the latest projections. That is, if I'm remembering correctly, roughly 6% of all the people who have ever lived. And that's based on some pretty simplistic math suggesting that there were two people in 50,000 BC when Homo sapiens, our species, appeared on the scene, and then just kind of extrapolating from there through their descendants and counting them all up, the 7 billion people alive today would be only about 6% of all the people who have ever lived. So that is definitely fiction.
And the world's population will stabilize at about 10 billion people sometime after when? Soon?
About the middle of this century, theoretically. I mean, that's the trouble with population projections is you're kind of making a guess as to how people will behave. But this much is clear from surveys around the world. We have passed, I guess, what could be called peak baby. That was back in the 60s and 70s when the most babies were being born around the world, more than two per woman. And we're down now closer to one. And that means that populations will stabilize at some point in the future.
Mm. So at that, given that's taking place, at that rate, the living will never outnumber the dead.
We're never going to catch up. We're never going to catch up unless there's some kind of crazy population explosion. And frankly, based on how things are going, I'm not sure that the Earth would support that kind
right.
of population explosion.
Yeah, exactly. Dennis in Ripon. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
Hi.
I was told once that bullfrogs do not have a memory, that whatever they see when they blink their eye, it's a whole new world to them when they open it. Is that true?
Is that true, David?
Well, we have not definitively tested that, and I would like to consult a bullfrog biologist. But you know, just from personal experience, I have a hard time believing that. Just because I've you know, bullfrogs are successful at capturing prey, I imagine that they take more than one blink to do so, and that would suggest to me that they have at least a memory for you know, the flies passing by.
Hmm. It's interesting to think of a being, though, every time he or she blinks, it's a whole new world.
It's a whole new world, yeah. Well, I mean, there are certainly insects out there that, you know, only live for a day, and I'm sure they have a very different perspective on time and memory than we humans do. And, of course, in the vast sweep of Earth's history, human history is a blip.
Yeah. Thanks, Dennis, for your call. John in Fitchburg. Hi. John. John, are you there? Hello, John. I thought I was hearing, I know he wanted to ask about cockroaches. I could almost hear them in the background. Could you? I don't know if I was imagining that or what. John, call us back. I don't know what happened to you. Adrian in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I super love your show, but I am going to beg your guest to lay off my vitamins. And I'll tell you why. I was a very sick child. I had literally no immune system. I was diagnosed with a disease of old age that's listed with the Rare Disorders Center of the CDC. If it happens to anyone, they're typically 80 and over. I was 7. It's called hydrogenitis supurativa. Mm-hmm. No doctor could help me. It was naturopaths and vitamins that cured me of that disease. And I'll tell you, it was painful and it was ugly. In my old age, I take no medications whatsoever. I am extremely healthy. I was diagnosed about 4 years ago with macular degeneration. The supplements that I took and am still taking to this day, my ophthalmologist cannot see that disease on my eyes anymore.
That's so great. I'm glad to hear that you know, that the diet is working for you. And I certainly didn't mean to suggest that vitamins play no role. The actual vitamins themselves, you know, the micronutrients are extremely important. The problems are, one, a lot of supplements are not, let's say, properly vetted, so you can never be sure what you're getting.
You do have to be careful, and there are ways of doing that. And
yeah, sure, no, but the micronutrients are better coming from food,
mm-hmm.
and actually diet is a great way to cure a lot of ills. But I'm very glad that this worked for you, and certainly, like for example, with vitamin D, you know, if you're living in a northerly climate and you're not getting a lot of sunshine, or you lack the ability to generate that through your skin due to some kind of disease, certainly you want to take a vitamin D supplement or drink a lot of milk, or you know, get it in some other way.
Yeah, I take vitamin D. Adrian, thank you very much for your call. Send us more information about your story, too. It sounds very interesting.
I will. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Men, do men have a biological clock? You reference in the book an Indian farmer who sired a healthy child at the age of 90 in 2007.
Yes, and I remember, I'm from St. Louis, Augie Bush, who was kind of the scion of the Bush family there, fathered a child in his 80s.
Wow.
So it is possible, but men do indeed have a biological clock, and in fact, our odds of successfully fathering a child go down quite significantly with the passing of the years. That said, we don't have kind of the hard stop that the biological clock of women suggests. But it is a myth to think that there is no impact of aging on men's ability to be fathers.
Mm-hmm. So do you come up with a recommendation? Does the book or the magazine come up with a recommendation? The best age with fewer possible complications is 35 or younger for both men and women?
Yeah, well, it's actually 40 or younger for men and 35 and younger for women, maybe. That's not to say, again, that you can't have children after that for both men and women, but the odds are more in your favor the younger you are as both a man and a woman.
We go to Rich next in Menominee. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I've heard this thing that when you leave a room, a baby thinks that you are gone forever.
Oh.
I have heard that too. But I don't know whether that's fact or fiction, and I have a hard time imagining how we would test that.
Right.
And that's the problem with a lot of these baby questions is they can't talk, so they can't tell us what they're feeling or thinking, and so we have to try to figure that out by other means. But that's a great question. I've definitely heard that. I don't know whether it's fact or fiction, and I don't know how we would figure that out. But maybe someone out there has figured out a way to do it.
Mm-hmm. What were we saying, Rich? Rich? No, Rich is gone. All those important things, don't you wish that at the moment we're born, we can't remember a darn thing about this incredible thing that happened when we were born, and that the moment we're gone, we can't tell people what happened? These two crucial things in all of our life cycles, and not a word about it.
The great mysteries of life. It's absolutely true.
Yeah. Glasses of water. Did we get to that, David? 8 glasses? Everybody says 8 glasses. I mean, people have been talking. That's, you know, all over the place. How many magazine articles have there been about 8 glasses
of
water?
It is true. It's true, and that there are a lot of articles.
Oh, okay.
It's not true that you need 8 glasses of water a day. And I guess the potentially surprising reason for that is that you get a lot of water in your food. Drinking 8 glasses of water a day isn't going to be bad for you, although, in fact, drinking too much water, perhaps surprisingly. Remember, we were talking earlier about the dose is the poison. Drinking a lot of water really fast can, in fact, kill you. But 8 glasses of water a day is not going to kill you, but it's also not necessary because you're getting a lot of water in your food as well.
Hmm. So tell me, how do these things gain hold? Because that is so much the common thought right now. Oh, I got to get my water in. People will drink a couple of extra glasses at the end of a day to make sure they've had 8 glasses of water.
That's right. Well, it seems to have sprung from a long ago report from the National Institutes of Medicine that suggested that you needed a certain amount of water for every calorie of food that you took in. And when you did the math, that worked out to roughly 8 glasses of water a day, and that kind of took hold in the popular imagination. But what that simple calculation left out was, like I said, that there is a lot of water in those vegetables and meats and everything else that we eat, where you're getting some of the water you need to process those calories directly with the calories. So 8 glasses a day is a myth. But if it's working for you, stick with it.
Yeah, what the heck. So, but the other thing is, people were saying in terms of diets, what you're really thinking when you want some food is you're thirsty. I can really tell the difference between the two. I thought that was interesting. If you drink something, it's going to cut down on your hunger, and so you're going to lose weight.
Yes, that is definitely a myth. That seems to be a theory that's held in some quarters anyway. Unfortunately, it's not true. I wish you could drink away your excess weight. I'd certainly be a lot skinnier if you could. But the reality is that the only way to lose weight is to kind of have a better diet and potentially exercise more for your health. You can't drink it away. And that you know, the 8 glasses of water a day, I guess the best guide for how much water you need to take in is actually how thirsty you are. Drink a glass of water when you feel thirsty. If you don't feel thirsty, no need to force yourself. And, of course, we're also getting water in a lot of those other beverages that we consume, coffee or tea or whatever else folks drink.
We got a message from a gentleman who wants to know about, I don't know if you've studied this, the benefits of iodized water.
Iodized water. We have not studied that. We did iodine in salt. That is certainly a health benefit. So it is a fact that you want your kind of fortified salt. It's better for your health and prevents goiters and things of that nature. I actually haven't heard of iodized water, so I can't answer that one.
How do you determine, what process do you go through to determine whether something is true or not true, David?
Well, we look to the science, as you would expect from a magazine named Scientific American. So basically, we turn to the experts, and we take some of these common myths and say, "Hey, you know, you're a veterinarian, or you're the Veterinary Society. Is chocolate poisonous to dogs? Tell us a little bit more about it." And fortunately for us, scientists are actually friendly folks, and they want to share their knowledge, and they do. And then we serve it up to you in these little columns.
We're going to welcome more phone calls for David in just one moment. We're going to go on to pets. Do they protect children against allergies? I told you we'd get back to dogs. Can dogs talk? We'll look at that. Does stress cause gray hair? Can it? We'll talk about that and other popular myths. The editors of Scientific American have a new book. It's an e-book, Fact or Fiction, Science Tackles 58 Popular Myths. And Scientific American editor David Biello is with us to talk about that this hour. We're welcoming phone calls from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And he did tell us that he has a picture on his wall of an elephant because we talked about elephants earlier. Picture that the elephant drew that's on his wall, and it's a good picture. So we asked him, and I'm sure he hasn't forgotten, because he has a mind somewhat like an elephant, to post that on our Facebook page, which we will do after this show is over. And we're going to do a show on elephants, because they're darned interesting. That will be coming up sometime soon. So more phone calls in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to pets for a moment and whether or not you can develop your immune system if you have pets early in your life. David?
Sadly, this appears to be fiction. But again, as sometimes happens with our factor fictions, this is a bit more of a gray area, and I'll go into it in a little more depth. Basically, the idea that pets provide some protection against allergies can be traced back to this hypothesis, this idea that the modern world is a much cleaner world, that we're not exposed to as many bits of microbes and dirt and other things in our modern lives. And if that and that that is the reason that our immune systems kind of overreact to what are natural pollens and all the rest of it as if they were disease, and that's allergies. And the thought is, if that's so, then maybe pets, which for all their pleasures do bring more stuff like dander and shed hair and other potential allergens into your life, might provide some training for your immune system against allergies. This does not appear to be the case based on the latest science. That doesn't mean that the hygiene hypothesis is wrong. It just requires more study.
Mm-hmm. What about these other, I don't know if there's studies or this is just common wisdom, that people who grow up on farms do have fewer allergies than populations that don't?
That is actually one of the strongest arguments for the hygiene hypothesis, and that actually appears to be true. What's unclear is whether that's because they are being exposed to more disease, because folks who are growing up on a farm, especially a farm that has cows or sheep or pigs or chickens, are exposed to these other diseases that afflict these animals. And they might not be bad for people, but they kind of train the immune system to recognize what is a disease and what is kind of a natural substance like pollen. Whereas a city kid like me, gets exposed to some grass pollen and starts sneezing up a storm because my immune system thinks, oh my gosh, this is some novel disease.
Mary in Madison is our next caller. Hello, Mary.
Hello. I think it's out of St. Louis, University of St. Louis. They're doing studies on aging and aging of genes and the body and restricting the amount of calories.
Right.
Like, for example, this one man is on a 1900 calorie diet per day, and his biological age, even though he's 50, his biological age is 30. Have you heard that?
So the results in humans of this what's called caloric restriction in scientific circles are kind of, the jury's still out on those. It is a fact, however, that caloric restriction in some animals, mice and worms so far, has been shown to extend life. The question is, how good is that life if you can't have butter? That's a joke.
it was funny. I got it.
So caloric restriction does seem to have some of these kind of life-extending properties in other animals. It remains to be seen whether that's true for humans. We are, after all, a little more complicated than mice and worms.
Yeah. Lisa, you have to know, do people ask you these questions all the time because of what you do for a living? It's interesting how many things you're really up on.
Well, I can only compare it to, I guess, actors who, like, play doctors on TV. I'm a journalist, but people seem to think I'm a scientist. I have been exposed to a lot of science, so I do know kind of the latest research in a lot of different areas, thanks to Fact or Fiction. But I certainly am not out there doing this research every day, which is why, you know, I can't answer the question about bullfrogs or whether caloric restriction is gonna work for people.
Yeah. Can dogs talk, though?
The answer is sadly no.
Aww.
I believe this one. And actually, I had a long back and forth with the folks who wrote this one because I was like, no, I've heard it myself. It has to be true. But it turns out I was just fooling myself. Dogs are very smart. They can mimic their owners. And that is, in fact, what they're doing, plus a little bit of our bias towards our beloved pets to believe that they're saying, I love you, when it's really something more along the lines of, woo-woo-woo.
Oh, that was good. That sounds like I love, yeah. Was that you or your dog?
That was me. I don't have a dog here today.
Yeah. It is amazing. The article goes on to talk about, I think it was a border collie who could understand an incredibly large number of words.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt that dogs are incredibly talented at kind of picking up cues, whether words or a glance or gestures or whatever else from their human companions. A dog's smarts are really best showcased in the way that they relate to us humans. They've really got us trained.
Yeah, they sure do. So let's talk about this pin. What's the story with the pin and NASA creating a $1 million space pin? Did they?
The old joke is that NASA spent millions of dollars to create a pen that would write in space, whereas the Russians were smart enough to just use a pencil. This turns out not to be true. NASA rocket scientists aren't quite that dumb. That said, there is a space pen. And I believe you can purchase it still from the NASA website.
Hmm. And this one's intriguing to me. I must confess I didn't read all of them, but I just, the topic is so intriguing. Infinity comes in different sizes. What?
Yeah, this is one of those mind-blowing bits of math. And if I do a poor job of imitating a scientist, I do an even worse job of imitating a mathematician. So I'll do my best to explain this.
Okay.
Basically, a really brilliant mathematician proved that infinities come in different sizes. And the best way I can explain this, and it's the way we explain it in the article, is think about the infinite series of natural numbers. That's the numbers you know as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and so on to infinity. That is an infinite set in the words of mathematics. It turns out there are more numbers between 1 and 2. If you think of all the decimal numbers that there can possibly be between 1 and 2, so 1.1, 1.01, 1.001, then there are all those natural numbers that I was talking about, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. He used his mathematical skills to prove this, doing a kind of how many apples are there, how many oranges are there, let's compare the two. Oh, my gosh, this infinity is bigger than that infinity. That turns out to be a fact, and a particularly mind-blowing fact as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it does. Indeed, it does. Well, thank you very, very much, David, for being with us. Please don't forget, but I know you have a mind like an elephant, so you won't. We have to, if Scotty can talk to you so we can figure out how to get the picture of the elephant so we can forever remember this.
I will email it to you.
I just want to,
it's more of an impressionist painting than a line drawing.
It's fine. It would be any better than any painting I could do. I'm sure, sure of that. Thanks, David. It was fun. David Biello, our guest, and he is a editor with Scientific American. We were talking about science tackles 58 popular myths, and we didn't even get to all of them. It's an e-book, so look it up, and you'll find yourselves being able to carry on all kinds of conversations about how many glasses of water you should drink a day. The bigger your brain, the smarter you are. We never got to that. Can opera singers shatter glass? Are raw vegetables healthier than cooked vegetables? Is chocolate poisonous to dogs? If somebody says to you, you have a memory like an elephant, is it a compliment? Can dogs talk? Just a few of the things that we discussed. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this program, and thanks everybody for your calls and for listening. Have a wonderful Labor Day weekend. We'll be with you again after Labor Day here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.